Welcome to Non-Fungible Rebels, a podcast where creators, tech, internet culture, crypto, and marketing meet each other. It's me, Annie Alexander, and in each episode, me and the Rebels will have a real unscripted talk, share genuine opinions, and show raw emotions. Should we start? Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Non-Fungible Rebels podcast. Today, I'm going to speak to Nick Almond, the CEO of Factory Lab. And you probably listened to or watched my interview with Paul. Paul recommended Nick, and it was a good choice. And I don't do this often, but I did cold message Nick, and he said yes. So very happy to have you over. Thanks for coming.
Thanks very much, Annie. And I just realized I was listening to your podcast from many years ago as well. So I'm very happy to be here and pleased to hear Paul recommended me. That's very nice.
Yeah, it was very, very nice surprise to realize that you were listening to my podcast because, yeah, sometimes podcasting kind of makes you feel like you're talking to yourself unless you actually meet the people who listen to it. So, yeah, really, really nice to meet another listener and now a guest. So, yeah, let's dive into this. I looked into your profile, and just like many of us, it's not like you've been doing this all your life and it's been your first career choice. So you had life before crypto. Mm-hmm. So what was it, and what was your, how did you end up in Web3?
Yeah, it does feel like before crypto period of my life. I was a scientist for quite a lot of, I started life as a physicist.
Yeah.
So I was a kind of I was in the academic institution for many years. So I kind of started as a physicist, ended up with a PhD in that, got kind of a sort of realized in physics, you get to this kind of, you can see your entire life in front of you because you get into this hyper specialized field. And I'd be talking to the same group of people working on the sub field of physics that I'd be sort of specializing in. And yeah, I just kind of wanted to bail out of that. I did a bit of time in astrophysics and then essentially moved into teaching mathematics and cryptography. And then ultimately I sort of realized a big root passion of mine was in education and making education systems better. So specialized in learning theory, educational design, curriculum development, that kind of thing. And then kind of just by virtue of doing the stuff that the other academics didn't want to do, I ended up in a kind of academic senior leadership position, ended up as a director of learning and teaching, ended up building a decentralized organization before DAOs and got really sort of pilled on decentralization sort of while crypto was in a very early state. I was doing that for, well, a long time. From about, 2000 to 2020, I was in academia, basically. Ended up at the London College of Fashion as an associate dean. And then at that time, I was really desperate to break into crypto and left for crypto full-time in 2020. And now I build DAO infrastructure.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, DAOs kind of emerged in the field, like very, I don't know, to me, the impression was that it kind of, it appeared and it immediately got the popularity and everyone was talking about it. Everyone was enthusiastic about it. During the previous hype cycle, way more than now probably, but still it was something that kind of emerged and developed really fast. And there are loads of talks about it. So maybe we can start with the DAOs and kind of dive into the rest, but
sure.
I really love the concept of the DAOs, and obviously it's so in line with the whole you know, ethos of decentralization. And I'm a big fan of communities. So like the community involvement and participation is something that I'm very passionate about. So the whole concept and idea of DAOs was very attractive to me. But later on, when I started digging deeper into existing DAOs, very often I was ending up being a bit disappointed because I was like, yes, the concept, the idea, like the whole thing behind it sounds really nice. The narrative is amazing. I really believe in it. But then when you look at the teams and the fact that most of the tokens are with the team, like, is it really decentralized? Is it actually doing what it's doing? Like, you know, so you end up realizing that, yeah, I mean, theoretically, it's amazing, but like how many actually build it the way where it does what it's supposed to do? And how do you kind of, you know, incentivize the community to be genuine and fair and honest and not have their own sort of personal agendas to push forward? So I think like those two things were a little bit kind of bringing everything back to human nature. And in this field, human nature hasn't really performed well enough yet. So I'm a bit skeptical about the whole thing. So I want you to convince me that I'm wrong, basically.
Yeah. You're not alone. A lot of people are very skeptical about that. I'm one of the few people that have kind of never wavered in this belief. I think you've got to kind of separate the theory and the practice a little bit, and which you've done already, right? You've said, like, you love the idea, the concept, and you'll find a lot of people who kind of believe in it, but also are also quite bearish on them as well. It's an interesting one. I'll say I'm very sold on decentralization in the broader concept, right? And albeit I'm known as a kind of DAO guy, it's really decentralization that I think is the kind of killer use case of all this, and that's the point of it all. And really, I just follow DAOs through as the way in which decentralization is truly realized. So there's, in my mind, there is a trajectory where basically all of these projects, unless they're just an immutable contract, so something like Uniswap V2, and that's it, there's no more. You're going to need some kind of mechanism for upgrading that or managing it or helping it grow. And so DAOs are somewhat of an inevitability in my mind. And people can be bearish on them all they want, but they're just necessary, right? So there's the kind of that element. It's also very early in their development. And in 2020, when I started, we started out as a prediction market because no one wanted DAOs at all. It was the most bearish thing in the world to say we wanted to be a DAO startup. People looked at Aragon, to a lesser extent DAO Stack, and just thought they'll never work, right? Just don't even try. So we kind of came in with a prediction market concept and built DAO infrastructure around it to try and get to where we are now, which is trying to build a sort of DAO launch pad of sorts called Factory DAO. But yeah, I think there's the theory and then there's the actual reality of getting these things done. And there's quite a disconnect. You mentioned the financial centralization, which is something that people often sort of neglect, actually. And, you know, it might be decentralized, but if 12 people can run everything anyway, is it genuinely decentralized? And it's actually, that's exactly the bit I'm most focused on. So I feel like there's going to be a new era of DAOs coming. That hype wave that we had in, I think it was about 2021, basically on the back of Constitution DAO. I knew that would fail. And I knew everyone was like, right, it's the year of the DAO. And I just knew it wasn't. It was too early. We haven't cracked the practices yet as much as anything else. So it's where the humans and technology mix. And the human bit's just so complicated. And how do we get to those pro-social activities that overcome those issues of human nature and greed and is exactly where we're at now. And I have a lot of, I'm still, you know, I'm a DAO permabull. I think we're going to get there. It's just going to be a long and bumpy road, basically. And I just intend to be in there chasing that. basically.
So would you say that we're in this phase of experimentation and trying things out and trying to figure out what would be the best way to implement it?
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, I think the whole space is just on-chain research experiments for the most part, yeah. Right? Still, the whole industry is in that state. DAOs are even more in that state. And yeah, I think there's a core of people who really believe in it and are building in it. And they're generally lovely people who have, you know, they're in the same way that I am, you know, that they believe in it, that they want to be part of it. And that community is where it's going to come from. I think what we need to do is move away from that era of just one coin, one vote voting. And a lot of people have got their eyes on identity-like structures that can, and really where it needs to go is to much more meritocratic dimension to the governance rather than plutocratic. So instead of just who's got the most money, it's who's doing the most work and who's doing it effectively. So I think we'll start to see a lot of that stuff drop over the next sort of 18 months, 2 years. And a lot of it is about just improving the trust models of the space generally. So a vast amount of projects just die because they're contingent on trusting a small group of people to action the outcomes of the project. And really DAOs just pass that responsibility outwards. And consequently, I think we'll end up with more anti-fragile systems because of it.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I'm just thinking, like, you were talking and when you mentioned, like, the small group of people that you end up trusting, which is, like, completely against the whole trustless mentality and where we were supposed to go towards. There's also probably this element of ego because, like, you know, if you look at Web3 founders and the sizes of their egos, it's kind of, the whole concept of the DAOs is basically stripping away that. And I don't know, like, how many founders are actually comfortable with that, right? So from you know, looking at the human side of it, apart from the greed and apart from everything else, I think that also probably plays a certain factor in that.
Yes. And I've been talking to people about DAOs for many years now. And I know when I'm barking up the wrong tree, when I'm talking to someone who I'm trying to sort of, you know, impress onto DAOs that are a solution, and then realize that these people never want to give up power. And that's fundamentally what it's about. It's about taking the power away from our core team and distributing it out as widely as possible, as is feasible.
Yeah.
And there's an attitude that why would I do that? I don't want to do that. And frankly, they're in the wrong game. it's a challenge. And part of that comes through a convincing action of being able to do it properly. And we've not had enough success stories of this working for people to say. So everyone's got the argument of like, no, it's a crazy idea to pass control over to these people and to you know, a reasonable degree, they're correct. So I think that's the phase we're in now. We need to have real practical practice of DAO's land where it's worked and people are going to pioneer in that. And that's not going to be the ego group that do that. And then they might eventually either have to capitulate to it because of regulations. The regulations are starting to drop and you need to be credibly decentralized. And that is going to force these people to give up power because otherwise they're fundamentally accountable for everything that happens in the project. And the book stops with them unless they're credibly decentralized. So I think
also. Yeah, and there were already cases, right?
Absolutely.
Kind of going and after DAO founders. Yeah.
Not just DAO. Yeah, I think there's. And this is where it gets a bit challenging. Because the narrative is starting to crystallize there where really they're trying to directly attack DAOs and their structures more so than the ego founder who controls the keys, which is a problem, right? Because actually these things are actually decentralizing the structure. But yeah, there's in many ways, the whole space is under attack from that sort of angle. But it's one of the big challenges of DAOs, right? They are a means to decentralize things. They can meaningfully pass power to a broader base. But we need to actually just do it now and start getting some of this stuff into practice.
I think it also, like, another kind of element of DAOs that probably plays a role is kind of the quality of the community, right? Because, like, you know, when you look at the crypto communities at the moment, especially if you look at kind of the meme coin communities or like specific sort of, you know, altcoin, DeFi coin communities, etc. There are very sort of extreme and like loads of maxes kind of just focusing on that stuff specifically. But also, like, they usually have that leader of the community from the team that acts as a cult leader, right? And if you have that status and if you have that kind of acceptance and that kind of influence, even if you decentralize it from the technical perspective, and even if you end up with these 10,000 community members having the power, do you actually delegate that power? Or, you know, if eventually you're controlling them anyway as a cult leader, like, how would that work? I don't know.
Yeah, I did a presentation on this a while ago on the kind of the structure of power in DAOs and crypto projects generally, and influencers are one of the interest. You know, you can effectively decentralize everything to a kind of direct democracy, but if there's a cult leader that says do this and everyone does it, then is it decentralized as well? Again, there's a lot of unlearning that needs to happen. It's going to be a slow process, but yeah, there's a dynamic where people do just expect the team in the center to do it for them, you know. And actually, it's a double-edged sword. Yes, you're a cult leader and you get to, you know, have all this, you know, command over all these people who, you know, doting on your every word. But they also expect you to pump the token, right? They also expect you, like, you do it. You market the token.
Or tell them how they could do it as well as an option.
I mean, that's a far better context. But yeah, I think there's a disempowerment that is kind of fairly systemic, which is, you know, an artifact of the world we live in my view, the centralized world where people aren't used to having any kind of agency over something like this. So I think there's a real empowerment dynamic that needs to happen. We need to find ways there, success stories of, you know, low token holder value participants actually meaningfully influencing a project. And if we get some of those wins, then I think that's how you can win over a community to say, and that comes down to the DAO leaders, as I like to call them, whose job it is to empower people to come in and take the reins and meaningfully do that, which is both an education job and a kind of governance job as well.
Yeah, well, it looks like it's going to be a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. It's a
long journey.
Yeah.
Until getting to where we would like to be, right, in that aspect. But again, like, you know, it's as you mentioned, it's not just DAOs, it's the whole space in general that kind of, you know, it's cyclical, right? Like, I've been around in the space since 2017, and this was, I believe, like third bear market, and it feels like we're just starting getting out of it. But when I'm looking back at all these three cycles and sort of, you know, how it started, how people behaved in the hype cycle, and, you know, the what happened, and then which were the mistakes and why everything went downturn and we ended up with the crypto winter, it feels to me that it's very similar, like the same thing over and over again. I'm having deja vus, although it's kind of the flavors are different. But, like, you know, we had the ICO. Same thing, human nature, greed, whatever. Then we ended up in bear. Then we had the DeFi summer, same thing. Then we had like the winter. Then we had the NFT boom. And then now we're getting out of the third winter. I don't know what the next thing would be, but I just feel like if we keep doing the same thing the same way, we're obviously are going to get the same results. And it's just a matter of time about whether when the next bear will be coming and how long it will be the nice kind of, you know, hype cycle, how long will it last, how many people will be able to take advantage of that stuff for how long, and then, you know, the same thing over and over again. Why do you think that is? Like, first of all, do you think that this upcoming cycle would be the same as well or not? And if yes, like, why don't we learn from our previous mistakes? Because they seem to be the same.
Yeah, I think about this a lot, actually. And I've seen close to four cycles now, getting increasingly deep into it each time and more exasperated each time that we just do the same thing over and over again.
The highs are higher, the lows are lower. That's how it's
even more volatile. I think there's a real possibility it could be even worse this cycle than the last one. I know.
Okay.
There's a kind of fork in the road in my mind, and it's a pretty soon, you know, it's whether we can steer out of making exactly the same mistakes again it's an imminent sort of question. I've got a few. Are you aware of the Gartner hype cycle, where you got this kind of like, there's a technology comes out, and then there's the peak of inflated expectations, and they call it the trough of disillusionment. It actually follows very close to that, right? We have this kind of hype cycle. It's much more hype centric. Fundamentals are far less important in crypto.
Yeah.
It's much more memetic. It's much more of a beauty contest. You know, it's like, you know, we get $30 billion dog money when the time is right. And essentially we have this, I have a spin on this, I call the crypto hype scam cycle, which is slightly different line shape. We have this thing where the new mechanic comes out, you know, whether it's NFTs or liquidity mining or sort of, you know, yield farming, whatever it is.
The next shiny thing, basically.
The next shiny thing. It's a trend. We call it a meta now, you know, and it runs through this thing. And essentially, you get this first wave of it, and it has this kind of hype, classic hype cycle bit, where it just plays out in the market, in the mechanics. The first wave of them are sort of digested in the market. People start to understand the game. So there's generally a game where it's very technical and weird, and only a handful of people know it, and then know how to play it, and then know how to consume it. And then it has a kind of second wave, which is much bigger than the first. And that's what I call the peak of max scam. And we saw this in NFTs, right? Which is, you know, there was a NFT hype wave. It was art centric. You know, there was this huge boom. Crypto punks ran up. Board apes ran up. And then it kind of played out and dumped down a little bit. And then we had this much bigger second run. And by the end of that one, it just all devolved into like everyone's doing it, right? The first one is the kind of innovators, if you like, are having a go at it. The people who understand the smart contracts and the kind of inner circle crowd. And then by the second one, everyone's having a go. You know, everyone's launching an NFT, you know, Fiverr JPEGs.
10K, 0.08 ETH means damned. And an animal, animal picture.
And in that run-up, you know, 5K Fiverr job NFT projects are raising $3 million. And then that just attracts in all the worst people in the world who just kind of exploit it to death. And then you get the real blow-up, and you get this huge, big... And then it's either it's gone forever, like we just don't ever see that mechanic again, or it eventually goes into another version of that cycle, which I think is where NFTs will do again. Slightly different mechanics, but almost exactly the same rerun will happen. My worry about this cycle is, I mean, if you sort of looked at the last one, largely it was all the centralized systems that blew up. Extremely trusted systems, you know, your FTX, your Celsius's, BlockFi. Luna was not a decentralized stablecoin, although people say that was DeFi. It wasn't DeFi. It was a simple mint and burn smart contract run by Do Kwon, right? And the whole thing was managed essentially, and they all blew up. And I'm not sure that will happen again this time. What I worry about this time is we have more decentralized economies, less dependency on putting all our money in centralized boxes, largely because the regulations are going to, like, no one's going to get away with the SBF play this time, because the feds will be on them. But what we will have is more decentralized token economies, but the token economies are broken. That means we seem to be listing everything that's starting at exceptionally high values. So, you know, your new protocols are launching at $30 billion, you know, DeFi, simple DeFi stuff that was around in 2020 is getting launched on new chains. And then, you know, the price starts at $7 billion FDVs. So everything's just starting at an incredibly high valuation, and the market always finds the true value. My worry is that, you know, people are we could have even bigger drop-offs in this time unless we more sensibly price it.
Because the starting point is unrealistically higher.
Exactly. Yeah, we're starting at absurd valuations, like the day one. So if it's going to go up, you know, most egregious example of this at the moment is WorldCoin. They've got 1% of their token supply in circulation, 1.3% of it. So, you know, there's 98% of the tokens still to come. All the investors are going to unlock, and it's valued at $60, $70 billion. And that is, anyone buying that is in trouble, basically. It doesn't mean it won't go up more, because the float is so low that the market can be controlled a little bit. But yeah, it's just a disaster waiting to happen. And it seems to be memetically where things are going at the moment. So
yeah, it feels like, yeah, go ahead, sorry.
No, I'm just saying, it just feels like we have an opportunity to stop doing that and fairly price assets in on day one. And that's the fork in the road, really. Do we start sensibly pricing things for the value that they are? Or do we just keep doing the centralization this time is the centralized launch. We need to fix the launches and do them in a decentralized way, basically.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And I think it's good you touched on price and value, because I think, like, you know, we can segue to that topic, because it's a very important topic, right? It's very sort of, in many cases, the way I feel it, based on my sort of observations of the market and participants in the market and the conversations in social media and sort of what people actually care about, the value that they see in something, whether it's an NFT, animal, JPEG, whether it's a token, DeFi token, whatever it's out there, is basically the potential of it for its price to go up. That's the value that they're seeing. So sort of, you know, they're comparing today's price. They have a certain sentiment based on whatever. It can be like a clueless influencer saying something, up to like technical analysis on a meme coin or whatever it is, like they are using as a toolkit for that decision making and forming that sentiment. But basically it's like, okay, it costs now so much. If I buy it, what is the probability of it going 10x? And, you know, based on your sentiment of how much is it, then, you know, you kind of end up understanding or feeling what the value of that thing is, right? And very often, obviously, it's also linked to how early you discover that thing, which is why people keep rushing and you know, to participate in the very first launch date, mint date, whatever it is, and it causes them clicking the wrong links, being scammed, paying outrageous high gas fees just to speed things up, et cetera, et cetera. So to me, it's like, is that actually a value though? Like, is it the value that we need to look into? And if it's not that, it shouldn't be that, then what it should be in that case?
Yeah, I love this question. I think what we're talking about there is essentially like price discovery. So there's value as price, which is what is the price of this thing? And the thing is like intangible, right? So we're talking about what's the price of a JPEG of a monkey, right? That now in reality, the value of that, we've already left reality behind, because the value of a monkey JPEG, you know, is nominal, right? It's, you know, but actually in reality, it's whatever people are willing to pay for it.
Yeah.
And the fact that we can essentially give this thing a secondary market with NFTs means that this conversation can be had out in public with a secondary market outside of traditional venues. And people can, you know, list it for whatever price they want. And if they've got a buyer, then, you know, that's the price of it. In reality, that game is open to manipulation, because I can list my, you know, Bored Ape for 100 ETH, and then I can buy it for myself for 100 ETH. And therefore, how real is the price discovery there is up for question, right? And the reality of price discovery is, you know, if lots of people are starting to, kind of a consensus problem, if lots of people are paying those values and those are real buyers, then it gets more real over time. So there's the more volume and trading around that price, the realer it is. It's entirely subjective, and you're in the realm of like hyper subjectivity. So whatever people are willing to pay. So it's one of the really interesting things about NFTs in particular, is that you can have this hyper subjective price discovery moment. It's very sensitive to influencers saying what the price is. And that game sort of plays out with, okay, we can form an insider group. We're all on the whitelist, you know, and we can just decide amongst ourselves what price we're going to sell them at and what price we're going to tell everyone the price is. And in some ways, this is a kind of price discovery game in itself, but it's the asymmetry in the market that's the problem. Kind of a lot of what I'm interested in is finding ways to mitigate that. But really what I'm genuinely interested in, and where the space needs to go, is what is the substance of that, moving beyond the JPEG, right? What's the point of these assets? What can you do with them? What's the utility? What does it give me? How does it improve my life? What's the real value of these things? And I, you know, unlike many people, actually believe that there is a genuine value to be had in these assets that has yet to be fully realized, I think. And again, we should be in this new era of, yes, this thing is more than just a JPEG. It's a passport to a DAO, is one of the things that I think it's rights within a community. It's a passport or proof that I have contributed to this system, and governance rights and things like that. So I think there is a realm of value that is yet underexplored, which is mostly just price.
Yeah, I think it's probably also because of the fact that the retail investors, you know, quantitative investors, obviously they're not, but like, you know, that big mass of the crowd in the crypto space, they, you know, the things you're talking about in terms of what the real value should be, they don't really understand much about that. So it's easier for them to understand, okay, you know, I buy it for 100 and then I sell it for 5,000 versus everything else that is much deeper and more complex and needs a bit of knowledge. And people are usually lazy. They don't really want to learn stuff. So it's kind of, you end up with this mess, which is kind of, you know, it's easier for them to listen to an influencer on Twitter space or read their shit posts and just follow the flow, which is why for me it's like a little bit, yes, we all know what happens in those alpha groups. We all know how back in the days during the DeFi summer, IDOs were structured and kind of influencers involved in the IDO launches and everything else, which kind of led to token, you know, price discovery and all that stuff, right? But although we know all that, I don't see sort of, you know, we had that nice sort of non-crypto story of GameStop, right? Where sort of the community came together and was like, hey, no, like, you know, we're going to decide what we're doing. We want to save this thing. We're just going to rebel, get together and do this, right? To me, it's very interesting and strange that in this environment where it's supposed to be sort of, you know, a crowd of rebels, because that's like was the whole purpose that brought most of the people into the space, knowing all that doesn't really kind of try to self-organize and do their own thing and kind of, you know, influence that price discovery and go against what's happening, because it's eventually, when you look at it, it's happening to them. At the end of the day, they are the exit liquidity. It's not like, you know, anyone else who's not participating in this thing is actually being impacted. It's them being kind of, you know, influenced by the whole sort of orchestrated play, and then ending up because of the greed and many other factors, becoming exit liquidity because they didn't themselves exit on time, right? Yeah. So it's a whole chase of kind of who's gonna sell and get out earlier. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, because of that whole the way the market is structured and the way the influencers operate, you finding that moment, it's against the odds, right? So
yes,
so I don't know,
impossible in many cases. I think there's a few things here. I think one, it's kind of the crowd that we've got at the moment. You know, the vast majority of people adopted into the top technology are kind of like, you know, degens, as we would call them, people in it for the quick buck. You know, number go up syndrome. You know, it's like, this is the people that we've got. Why?
Yeah.
Because we've yet to really find the true value. We've yet to show that this technology can meaningfully have a positive impact on everyday people's lives. You know, we've not found the use cases yet. I think we will, and in many we've been iteratively getting closer to that. I think we get slowed down by bear markets. I think the, you know, essentially there's bear market and all the VCs stop funding stuff and run away. So the existing funded projects that were,
because
probably,
they too act as degens, right?
Yeah, 100%. It's just, you know, it's the gambler's mentality. Everyone thinks they're going to be on the right side of the game. And really being on the right side of the game is, did you get into the seed round? And until we sort of, I talk a little bit about what the solutions to this might be, but I think, the bull market ends when every resale participant has lost their money, right? There's just simply no more buyers. You can launch a token and everyone in the world doesn't buy it. You know, it's a truly global system, but there is no token buyers because no one's got any money left. Right. The extraction game is played out. And in many ways, this is what like democratization looks like. We've let the barriers to entry go to zero, essentially, but through permissionless technologies. And we've got the Wild West. And we've got the Wild West, and the Wild West has its power players, you know, that are free reign dominant. Everyone sort of likes this game, even the people that, you know, because there are people who get in at the right time, and some of the retail group make their, you know, 1000x, and you get the stories of people turning three digit numbers of money into millions of dollars, and that's what keeps the kind of dynamic going. But it's short lived, and you know, we attract gamblers, that's the crowd. And until we grow beyond that, we're stuck with that. And I think that's kind of fundamentally the problem. And unless we find, you know, that better form of value, it's exactly what's going to happen on this cycle. If anything, it's just even fewer people are going to win, right? Yeah. Even in the private secondary markets, there's people buying, you know, tokens out there at the moment that are already overvalued in the private secondary markets directly from the VCs. People with the insider alpha are getting wrecked now, like, or soon to be wrecked, right? So even the inner circle is buying stuff at incredibly overinflated values, you know, and the number of people winning is getting smaller and smaller. So that's the problem. What I think the solution might be is decentralization, right? We go back to something closer to ICOs, where there is, you know, the open crowd sales. You know, it's the asymmetry in the market that's the problem.
Yeah.
You know, if the token supply is cornered on day one by, you know, a dozen, you know, venture partners, then
it's basically gated, right? And that's, I mean, the whole purpose of ICOs was basically kind of, you know, get rid of the gatekeepers from both sides, like from the person who is fundraising, but also from the people who actually want to invest. So like there was no one saying them you can't. And it worked pretty well because I personally was you know, I had a speech at an event back in those days, right after we raised at an ICO, you know, I was part of an ICO team. And one of the VC representatives was listening to our story because I was kind of, you know, telling it from stage. And he got so frustrated, he couldn't really keep his emotions. And he started shouting at me in the middle of the speech. Because they felt like they were losing power, right? Mm. Because that's what was happening. Because yes. They were no longer in those environments. They were no longer so important and they were not used to that, right? I mean, I was kind of, you know, a relatively young woman standing on a stage saying, oh, we raised 20 million and, you know, we didn't need the VCs. We didn't get any sort of, you know, traditional funding. It was from 10,000 people from all over the world. So that kind of was a message that they didn't really like. And they no one knew how it was going to develop further. So yes. Obviously, you know, they were worried and they felt like it was a threat, right? Obviously, we all screwed up the whole system as, you know, kind of greedy human beings, and ICOs had so many issues later on that it's kind of lost the whole trust. But in terms of how it was structured, it worked. And, you know, there were no whitelists, there were no gatekeepers. Like all these 10,000 people had a chance to participate with as much as they wanted, and no one was there to keep them away. So I do believe it was a really good system. It's just that, and technically it worked pretty well, like, you know, but it was the human side of things that kind of started getting into the whole thing and again, screwed up the whole nice concept. Yet another nice concept was kind of destroyed because
absolutely.
Of that.
Yeah, so I think you saw a golden era of the ICOs there, and that was when it was super exciting. You know, that there was a real talk of disrupting venture capital and disrupting venture sort of capital and disrupting capital formation for innovation. And really, one of the things that excited me the most was the potential for this to open up a new era of innovation, because the barrier to entry got a lot lower. You know, your real person with, so I've been in a position where I've had what I believe to be brilliant ideas and had no capital to put them off. You know, was poor academic. You know, how do I get the money together to be able to put this idea together? One of the reasons why I'm so excited about DAOs is that, you know, is a potential, like, okay, here's an idea. Does anyone want to be a part of this with me? And you can do that without needing to know investors. Or even having to quit your job, right? And cut away your go it alone in the startup world, which I've just done for the last few years, is one of the most terrifying and difficult things to do.
It is, hard.
So opening up the like lowering the barrier to entry to capital formation and getting ideas off the ground is the big promise of a lot of this stuff. And yeah, it was genuinely, that's where the vitality in the industry was. But if you look at what happened, the regulator said these are illegal because people are getting scammed, and some people did. The game played out. We had the peak of max scam on ICOs. The mechanism played out. But what we didn't have is the next evolution of that mechanism, because the regulator scared it away.
The accountability part was missing, because, like, at the end of the day, essentially, what was happening with ICOs is you were selling a promise that you were going to build something, right? Mm-hmm. But then there was no way to keep you accountable in terms of whether you're going to fulfill that promise or not. And back in those Wild West times when you weren't fulfilling that promise, like, no one would do anything to you. So it was this lack of accountability, and the fact that you could raise millions without any product, with just a white paper. Back in those days, many would write those white papers as a science fiction stories, because in some cases it wasn't even technically possible, but then who knew that, right? Like, and who cared? So I think that was like the second stage of, okay, how do you actually put this tech to also ensure implementation. So let's say, you know, you raise that into ISCRO, and then with each roadmap stage, once you deliver, only then you get that portion or whatever. I don't know, but like, we didn't have any of that. So people would get that kind of, you know, those millions and millions in a matter of several hours into a multi-sig wallet in best case, sometimes not even. And then, you know, what happens later is kind of, I mean, how do you know how you can trust the team, right?
And this is where DAOs come in. And this was the point of it, right? So we actually started this conversation around DICOs. They called them, Vitalik wrote a paper called The DICO, which is a combination of DAO and ICO, which is essentially you have public accountability over the treasury, and there's a sort of permissioning structure around. And I genuinely believe we would have evolved that mechanism if the market had been allowed to play out in an open fashion. But in reality, what happened, everyone got scared of doing decentralized crowdfunding. Obviously, the VCs are happy with that, which shouting at you certainly was happy about that. And so you end up in this kind of perverse incentive game where the real open crowdfunding mechanisms never evolved out in the market. The beauty of crypto is you have this open innovation of evolutionary Darwinian mechanisms that play out where the better outcomes just evolve in a sort of natural fashion. And we never had that. And instead it all moved into the private markets, which ultimately ended up in this incredibly cornered game where people on the outer ring of the VC game are getting rugged before it even gets to the retail market. So yes, we had this kind of peak of max scam in ICOs, and everyone's just priced that in as like, these are terrible ideas. It's over. It's never coming back. Actually, what should have happened is we had the second and third and fourth round of these things out in public, and it iterates to better games each time. And I still think that's going to happen. It's just been slowed down by the specter of the state coming in and stopping it happening. And this is a perfect example of how bad regulation or lack of regulatory clarity or just sort of hegemonic power can have more damage on people than, you know, just do nothing, right? I think more people have been hurt in the market over the last two or three cycles because of people being too scared to evolve proper crowdfunding mechanisms and opening them up to broader distributions.
Yeah, no, I get it. And I think we still have that lack of accountability, right? I remember back in the DeFi summer times, we had so many of those kind of, you know, explodes of the protocol contracts and things, remember? Like, and millions and millions were drained out of the contract. And I remember sort of what really surprised me was when you were having conversations about those, first of all, like, people got immune to it. And after a few, like, it was kind of, another, like, whatever happened. No one really cared that much anymore because it was happening so often.
Yes.
And the second thing was that the whole reaction, it was like, yeah, of course, it is DeFi. Like, if you don't have, if you can't stomach it, you shouldn't be there. It's risky. Mm-hmm. Of course it's risky. This is how it is. And people were accepting that fact like really well, and it felt completely normal to them. And I was like, yeah, but you're enabling that for happening again, because like, you know, if you are accepting it, if you don't have any criticism and no one is ending up being accountable for those, of course they will happen again and again, because people are tempted to even kind of orchestrate those and call them explodes. Like, who can even prove whether those were genuine explodes or kind of, you know, a story of an explode, but in reality those were just done by the team themselves. So to me, that accountability part, accountability about, you know, what you develop and what you put out in the market and the quality of your service, but also accountability of all these influencers who keep promoting stuff that ends rugged at the end of the day. Like, no one really kind of, you know, every time something happens, we forget about that so fast. And yes. I think that is why the cycles continue, because we forget about things. FTX was just a larger scale of things that had happened before, but yes. at a smaller scale, right? So if you kind of paid attention of what happened before and made your own conclusions, probably you wouldn't be so shocked about FTX or any other thing that happened yes. afterwards. Because it was just an inflated version, kind of a larger scale version of the same thing. So to me, it's kind of, it gets larger and larger, because when it's still small, no one cares and no one mm-hmm. really criticizes it so much. So yes. I don't know, like, probably that's part of the problem as well. Maybe that's why we keep having these bad actors continuing doing the same thing over and over again, because they know it works.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting subject, this. I think the question of accountability and in this industry is going to be such an interesting one. In many ways, people have just sort of deferred it to when the regulations are going to come. The regulations are going to sort all this out. They're going to put the accountability on people. But in reality, it's going to be very difficult, because anyone, any anonymous group of people can launch a DeFi project. You know, it can be set up by a group of pudgy penguins and no one can stop them, because it's a permissionless protocol, and people will put money in it in any case. And actually, the regulators are going to be slow and enforcement's going to be hard. And the reality of it is, the kind of criminals and degens and all that is still going to be running these things and promising people 1,000x, and they're still going to happen. There's nothing that you can do to stop them. So you're kind of in the realm of game theory instead, right? So game theoretic sort of accountability. I think the question around audits and software code, I think the hacks was a really interesting one. I also noticed, you know, $100 million would go down. You know, we had $600 million bridge hacks, and it got to the point where people weren't even batting an eyelid anymore. You know, people were just like, oh, well, there's another few hundred million dollars gone. And it got to the point where the code was getting really sloppy. And and what you mentioned there, the team is sort of in on it. I call it a sly rug, which is like, you know, the, oh no, we've been hacked. And, you know, actually they've left a vulnerability in the project that allows a hacker to take the money, and they knew it was there. And the whole thing was a scam.
I think even if, like, you know, that's my theory, that some of them were not even hacks, but like, even when they were, I think the problem was that everyone was in such a rush to put something out there. It was kind of, you know, a matter mm-hmm. of competing over speed. Yes. That in such a short period of time, it was normal for, you know, mistakes to happen, because of course it was sloppy. Like, you can't really put out something of a good quality if you're doing mm-hmm. it within two days or 3 days in a rush, just because, you know, someone else is doing something similar, or just because you don't know how long it's going to last and you really want to put a token out there just to make sure that you're on time, right? So I think it was kind of a mixture of both kind of things, like, you know, not knowing that nothing is going to happen, pretending it was a hack, or just being in a rush and doing all these mistakes, not auditing stuff and just, you know, putting it out there as is, just to be among the first ones. So it's kind of the thing. But we spoke up a little bit about the value. We didn't speak too much about the utility, because I remember mm-hmm. like at the NFT hype cycle, at one point, utility became this kind of, you know, the most commonly used keyword. Like, utility and community, like, both mm-hmm. of them were competing in terms of how many times people were using it and all that stuff. And in many cases, utility for NFT, especially PFP projects, was claimed to be the community and access to the community and the membership to a community. And I kind of didn't really buy that narrative, because to me it was like, okay, what is happening in this market? It's a community of people who came to your community because you promised them that they are going to get rich. As soon as they won't get rich, they will leave the community. So you end up telling me that the utility of this is being part of a community of speculators that don't care about the project, that kind of doesn't sound good. So I don't know, like, the real utility, like what are we going to look into? Like when is the real, I mean, obviously you have to make up some utility because that's like, you have to tell something. You can't really say, yeah, it's a worthless token that does nothing. And, you know, the market will decide how much it costs because maybe it won't work. But then when you make up utility, that is kind of pointless and doesn't really play into a sustainable business model.
Yeah.
How do you approach this? Like, you know, because releasing a token for the sake of the, obviously I know why people are putting out a token out there again for getting money, for fundraising. Obviously they want, I had loads of conversations with people who would say, I have this idea, I want to do it through NFTs or through tokens. And I would say, yeah, but it doesn't really make sense. You don't need a token. And he's like, I know, but I need one because I need to raise funds, right?
Yeah.
So then you artificially start sort of putting some stuff in there that doesn't even need to be there. So how are we going to develop, like, how is it going to play out in the future? Like, are we going to keep pretending that something has a utility while it doesn't, or how does it work?
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, a very interesting question. I'm very interested in token economics and what utility might look like in terms of token economies. I think there's the NFT, in many ways, the NFT boom was the ICO boom of the last cycle. It sort of descended into, you know, we're raising money to build this thing. And actually, it started out with art and ended up with ICOs, essentially. And then to keep the game going a little bit, we had this utility bit where you would get merch and it just, like, everyone just copied the same ideas for utility, you know. And it sort of played out. And in fact, you're better just keeping it at art, right? As soon as you start promising things, things get a little bit more complicated.
Yeah, and even merch, like, it complicates everything. Like, you know, buying a merch on Amazon with one click is so much easier than kind of, you know, investing or kind of buying an NFT for a project. So later on, after 6 months, they will send me a cheap hoodie. It just doesn't make sense.
And people didn't even get the merch most of the time. You know, so, but yeah, I think so.
And it was an expensive merch. If you look at it, how much you paid for your NFTs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's, again, it's just memetic, right? You know, like, what merch do you have or what utility do you have just became the meme. Like, you have to have the meme in order for this to be worth anything. So it's just a kind of this memetic game that plays out and then you're on the way to the max scam time. And I think there's, yeah, it's part of this kind of trend. I always think this is, we're closer to kind of content than financial assets. It's like they're not stocks. It's closer to fashion trends, like memetic trends, right? Closer to content than it is to assets, right? Or finance. Certainly in the NFT space. So yeah, and the community thing, I think it really depends on the community. There are groups that you can be in that actually bring value to you. But yeah, if they're all token degens, then no one's there actually for the community. It really depends. And I do think there is, I've been in groups here that I would definitely pay to be a part of because they've brought value to my life. And that's one of the, you know, being part of our community and working on stuff together can be valuable. It's just that, you know, we didn't do much of it, right?
So, I think the sad part of the whole thing is that those communities are usually not so popular and visible and known.
Yes.
So, like, you know, when I'm intentionally looking for such communities to be part of, and it's so hard to find them because, like, the ones that you hear everywhere are the ones that are not those that you mentioned, right? So actually finding those is a tricky thing. And those are not popular. Those are not so loud. Those are not the ones that everyone is talking about, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So I think that is where the unfair disbalance comes from. Right?
Yeah. And it's largely because they're not playing the game, right? And bribing the influencers. And, you know, and I think we have this kind of, there's a kind of philosophical idea of, like, the value selection hypothesis of the universe. Like, we live in a universe with life in it because there's a value selection that's happening. We have the inverse value selection, where the closer it is to just pure numbers, number go up, you know, meaninglessness, the more bullish it is, right? You know, the more closer to cat with hat or whatever, the better. And until we get past that, I'm afraid that, you know, we're doomed to sort of repeat the whole cycles again. But yeah, you're right. There is great communities out there of people doing really meaningful stuff. It's just underground. And that's largely where the underground communities that exist at the real crypto conferences are really the best thing about the industry. And I'm hoping for a kind of inversion of this at some point, where some of these projects are allowed to play the game, but in a way that doesn't corrupt their values. There's better discovery. And again, I do think it's like more effective governance, better coordination games that will allow people to play the game a little bit better. So I'm hopeful the industry.
Yeah, no, I am too, improve. Because I'm still here, obviously. But it's it's always it's also should sort of I feel like, you know, when there are shortcomings or issues or problems, we should voice them out. Like very often, like, you know, that whole toxic vug-me sort of energy, which kind of, you know, forbids everyone to tell anything negative about the space. I don't really, like, unless you speak about them, how are you gonna, first of all, acknowledge that there is a problem, and second, think about, you know, solving those problems. So I'm not really kind of, you know, obviously like super pessimistic or kind of focusing on the negative, but I feel like, you know, we shouldn't avoid and completely sort of forget about the negative existing, because like if no one talks about it, who is going to address those anyway?
We so banned the word FUD about, like, it's like, you know, the FUD's a real thing, right? Like IBM invented it to keep their market share. You know, it's like false misinformation that's negative, you know, negative misinformation about a project.
Yeah.
Well, we've misconstrued that to mean saying anything negative at all is FUD.
That's the thing.
It's an anti-criticality in the space that's like, yeah, it's a real problem.
Yeah.
I do think like self-regulatory approaches to this, I do imagine there'll be DAOs that do an analytical work on projects across the space that become kind of trusted entities with smart people, and people are paid to do it. So real self-regulation activity is really what's needed, because that regulatory activity from outside the space, they simply don't understand what's going on. There's no way that they could properly, because
by the time they learn about the technology or implications or what is happening in the market, it's already like in whatever happens in the market is already like that thing is gone. So it's hard for them to catch up. That you mentioned something that I think would be a nice way to wrap this up, because we're already at an hour. You mentioned bribing the community, and I think that's the biggest issue. And we saw the bribing part a lot during the DeFi summer, where we had like airdrops, right? Because we had all these DeFi protocols that at the end of the day, they weren't really differentiating much from each other. It was basically the same thing. And every time the new one emerged, they would airdrop and kind of, you know, lure users from one protocol to theirs. And then the next one would airdrop even bigger amount to lure them again. So people were just, you know, rotating from protocol to protocol, collecting all these airdrops and then sort of, you know, going wherever, whoever would pay better, right?
Yes.
Now these days, things started warming up. I feel like this whole airdrop season is restarting again, it feels like. I don't know, but I hear a lot of stuff about airdrops happening at the moment, and some people even complain that it's hard to keep up with all of them. But at the end of the day, if you attract your community through airdrops, I don't know, is it actually your community, or are you just bringing them in for a very short period of time until someone else does a bigger amount, bigger airdrop afterwards? Or like, you know, does it like how the whole this dynamic of airdrops, like what role does it play, and how do you think it's going to develop?
Yeah, very interesting subject this. I think, so it's like the ultimate, like crypto has this ability to dial things up to 11 to take existing phenomena and make them really obvious. You know, it's just like stuff that happens in the real world, we'd call this mercenary capital, right? You know, there's people there that are just there for the money, you know, then they'll move on to something else. And I think it was Andre Cronje called these liquidity locusts back in the day, in DeFi summer, which was largely this liquidity mining game. You know, DeFi projects would bootstrap massive liquidity because they were getting free governance tokens. SushiSwap managed to vampire attack Uniswap. So that kind of phenomenon happened in Uniswap, give away, you know, I think it was 10% of the token supply via liquidity mining. And then as soon as it stopped, all that liquidity moved over to Sushi. And promised to never turn it.
Yeah, out. Uniswap's airdrop was massive. I think it was over 6 billion or something. It was like enormous amount of the Uni token airdrop was.
Yeah, that was very much the trendsetter, and largely it was a technical innovation on the Merkle drop, which allowed you airdrops are very much a thing in like 2016-17, but it involved sending the tokens on the blockchain to everyone, and the Merkle drop allows people to pick it up themselves, pay the gas, and it makes it feasible to do, you know, potentially millions of people. And we've developed a tool for this, and it's a real thing. If you imagine a DAO formation, we're going to do something like this with Factory DAO, is that, you know, imagine that you're building a decentralized entity, and who should get the token? It's the people who built the thing, right? So if you can, if you've got a decentralized system that's truly emergent, it gets to this point where all of these people have contributed and created value together. Who should do it? It should be proportional to who created the value. Classic sweat equity type idea. And that's where the airdrops could be great, right? They're a mechanism to say, okay, we're at the point where we've got a token's got utility.
But those kind of, you know, those are not the bribe airdrops, those are reward airdrops, right? I think there is this big sort of fundamental difference in principle in terms of what you're giving it for, right?
Yeah, to be clear, I don't think we've seen any of these, right? I don't think one of them has happened yet, right? All we've had is this, like, you know, and to a certain degree, Uni started this game. If you've used the product, you've done us a big favor. You've helped us, like, you've rewarded us for using the protocol.
Yeah, usage linked. Mm-hmm.
And then, but once that game is in the market, it gets exploited. One of my mantras is every game will be gamed. So as soon as that game has happened, the next iteration has to be different. Otherwise, it just gets exploited.
Yeah.
And yeah, where we're at the moment is everyone's trying to play this game of distributing the initial token supply on launch out to all of these people. And we're in this game of it being, you know, playing out. And there's just, they all get Sybil attacked, you know, which is when everyone's just trying to game this game by setting up many accounts. And, you know, we're starting to see these airdrops happen. So the Starknet one recently was, you know, tokens went to Ethereum validators. Nice and easy, hard to Sybil because there's money involved. But the problem is all those tokens just go to people who are already rich. Basically, you know, people who are holding large amounts of tokens get the most, and largely that's a good idea because they're the people who have the money to, you know, who are now interested in that token having high value.
So
the answer is, I think airdrops are an absolutely core primitive in the space and will be around for a long time. I think doing them in a way that is decentralized is where it needs to go. So at the moment, you've got this centralized team decides who gets the tokens and for what. And consequently, they have an asymmetry in the market that allows people to abuse that system before it's coming. You know, maybe they're super honest and don't tell anyone, but it elevates the team and the community against each other, right? It creates a dynamic. It creates a power dynamic that... I find kind of unsettling and kind of against the grain of the direction. So yeah, it's a mechanic. It's going to be a real theme of this space this year and throughout the cycle. I think Sybil attacks are going to be a huge narrative, and people are going to suggest things like WorldCoin and biometrics as a solution, and it's going to be a mistake. But yeah, I think it's going to come down to actually rewarding contributors for genuinely building the thing in a decentralized manner, which is where it needs to go.
Okay. I guess the last question would be, like, it feels like a lot of stuff will be happening soon because the market is warming up. The bull will be coming. We don't know yet when exactly, but it feels like it's going to happen soon. How do we prepare for it?
Yeah, I think it's already happening. You know, if you look back, it's largely people have been sidelined because everyone lost their money, you know, thanks to Sam Bankman-Fried and friends. And largely no one had any money, even if you believed in it, to participate in the market. And I think largely the whole run for the last, you know, year or so has been institutions buying the dip, and largely the retail market has been sidelined, or the people who lost their money have gone, won't come back. I think it's likely if we'll have the crazy run, it could be even a sharper spike this time. Sell the top, you know, sell. Don't think this is the
take
new
profit.
Take yeah. profits. It's just like if you've got the right exposure to the market, learn where the asymmetry is. You know, if there's a project and all the tokens are in a multi-sig and they can dump them, they will dump them. They will, you know, if there's...
Yeah, it's just a matter of time, isn't it? Yeah.
Just a matter of time before those tokens make it into the market. If there's a trust hole in the market, again, one of my mantras is everything that can be rugged will be rugged. The point of this is trust minimized systems. Don't trust centralized teams not to dump on you. They will. Don't put your money in centralized boxes. Another exchange or more will go down. Self-custody, but look after your keys. And find the right communities is one of these things. Get involved in DAOs and learn, you know.
Those underground communities.
Go to the underground. Find the, you know, get involved in like the real culture of the space, and go to meetups, go to conferences, go to the side events. Don't pay for the, you know, if it's a massive conference and it's £600 a ticket, just go to the side events.
Much better, isn't it?
Find the real base and real root of the industry. That's where the cool stuff is.
Yeah, definitely. I have the same experience. And I feel like, you know, even if you go to these big conferences, in most of the times you spend your time outside networking and talking to people while there are the same speeches by the same people telling the same thing. So it's kind of, there isn't much to listen and learn anyway. But yeah, well, thank you so much, Nick. I really enjoyed the conversation. To be fair, I was a bit worried about this one because I was like, oh my God, like a physicist, someone like quite techy in the field, like, am I going to be able to sort of, you know, to be at the same pace and understand everything that he's saying. But yeah, you kept it very human and pretty easy to understand, which is always good for my audience as well. So thank you for that.
No, I've very much enjoyed it and had a lovely conversation. I'm glad I didn't boggle your mind. But yeah, no, I've had fun. It's been lovely.
Thank you so much.
That's all that I've got for you today. If you want more of my content, please check out my newsletter at annealexander.com/subscribe. And I'll see you in the next episode.